Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I want to thank the symposium organizers for inviting me to speak. And I am going to talk about integrated management. And so I'm going to be thinking and encouraging you to think about agricultural systems, but how we might start also understanding what kinds of microbial metabolisms could be occurring in agroecosystem soils that we are trying to become more intensified, but also in an ecological manner, and relate that to the nutrient flow in soils. So the themes of my talk, well, first of all, is undisturbed native soils are typically considered to be very tight in their nutrient cycling. On the other hand, agricultural soils are considered to be leaky. So what are, you know, some of the processes that might be occurring that could account for the relative differences in leakiness? Well, when farmers are trying to reduce tillage and increase organic matter in their soils, I think they are recognizing the fact that disturbance in tillage really does cause carbon loss overall, and we have a better appreciation that we need to return soils to higher organic matter levels and less disturbance to make soils more resilient. So one could say that when you reduce disturbance and increase carbon, you're trying to make agroecosystem soils more like native soils. So how realistic is that? I want to propose a few possible microbial metabolisms that might actually be happening in native soils that we might want to try to promote in agricultural soils, and how can management achieve this? Okay, this is a nice diagram from Ron Amundsen comparing undisturbed soils versus domesticated soils. And again, it's that theme that undisturbed soils are not very leaky, they're very retentive. To a great extent, erosion is very minimal in undisturbed soils. Plant carbon uptake and then microbial loss is fairly well balanced. Nutrient input is fairly well balanced, as opposed to our managed soils where we have a great deal more erosion, much more loss of CO2 as opposed to what carbon is put into the system, and there is a lot more nutrient loss, and in particular nitrogen. I think, as Stuart had pointed out, half of our fertilizer nitrogen is not used by plants, and we really need to address that in agroecosystems. So today, I think there is a good body of understanding of how no-till can improve soil quality and infiltration, but I think we are getting to a point where we're having a more nuanced understanding of how no-till and different reduced tillage practices are affecting our soil conditions. But we have had a very strong increase in reduced tillage, just nearly fourfold increase in acreage in commodity crops from 1990 to 2004. And as of 2010 and 11, you know, we had almost 40% of U.S. acreage in commodity crops in either no-till or strip-till. This is a nice map that comes from USDA Economic Research Service, and it indicates that in the Southeast, we have very high adoption of conservation tillage. I'm not really, I guess part of it might be due to the fact that the crops are somewhat more amenable to that, but I thought that was interesting. But what is also happening besides adoption of no-tillage is adoption of cover cropping. So again, growers are really trying to increase that carbon accretion process. And again, in the Southeast, we have more cover cropping. So a lot of no-till farmers are also adopting cover cropping. And we've seen this increase in cover cropping as well. So this integrated package of practices, I think, is sort of driven by an understanding that we want to drive agricultural soils toward more natural, more undisturbed types of conditions. This graphic from Keith Postian's article on climate smart soils, again, kind of points to the use of multiple interventions on the same land. They point out that in converting from more conventional practices to more climate smart practices, there's a shift from higher amounts of N2O lost as well as CO2. When you're moving to more climate smart systems, you're having more fixation of carbon and less losses of nitrous oxide, both by this nitrification arrow, red, and the denitrification arrow, which is orange. But the combination of practices to achieve this beneficial greenhouse gas effect is really based on the use of multiple practices, reducing physical disturbance, diversifying crops through rotations, extending periods of time with living plant roots, where plant roots are exuding compounds into the soil and feeding the soil microbial biomass, but also adding organic amendments like manure, compost, and biochar. So often we have a triple whammy where farmers are combining all three of these practices again to try and make their soils more healthy. I'll just mention that the research project that my group has been focusing on through a USDA grant is a sustainable dairy cropping systems project, where we are trying to model a dairy farm. So this is a 1/20th scale model of a 240-acre dairy farm, so it's quite a bit smaller. But the rotations of feed, forage, and fuel crops are all designed to be to make that farm self-sufficient. And we're measuring the yield and quality of the crops and making sure that they're adequate to feed our virtual herd of cows. We don't actually have cows. But in these rotation systems here, this is a conventional corn soybean that we're using as a comparison on the same soils. We are combining no-till application of raw dairy manure as well as cover cropping. And the application of dairy manure, we're comparing both broadcast and injection. And what happens when you broadcast dairy manure onto soils that have just recently had a cover crop, you know, removed, or when you're starting to plant, there's a lot of ammonia lost due to volatilization. So the shallow disc injection of manure is designed to reduce those ammonia losses, but what happens is that there is an increase in N2O. So this is the work of Kurt Dell at USDA ARS, showing that there is a bit of a trade-off when you go from broadcast manure to injection of manure. But the point is that, again, this is a combination of effects, and we want to understand what's happening to the conditions of the soil. So if I step back and think about how higher carbon, low disturbance practices are affecting soil, we might think about how native soil conditions, which are more quiescent, generally lend to soils that have more biophysical integrity, better structure, a higher proportion of macroaggregate volume, and more macropore connectivity and tortuosity. All of these can influence the nature or the composition of the pore gases. So we've talked about pore or soil water, but pore gases in oxic soils or aerated soils could very well allow for a buildup of metabolic products like carbon dioxide, possibly fermentation products like hydrogen, possibly volatile organic compounds that may be waste products of fermentative processes. So what you're trying to imagine is that in quiescent soils, where we have a buildup of these products in soil pores, we are able to promote the uptake or the reuptake, as Cynthia was pointing out. We're hoping to have trash being converted to treasure. So when we have more quiescent soils, more organic matter, we're hoping to facilitate these processes. And that's for reduced tillage, reduced disturbance. And then when we're adding additional cover crops and trying to enhance above-ground diversity, We're increasing the proportion of soil that is affected by rhizosphere, so there's greater volume of rhizosphere-affected soil, so that certainly is going to activate the microbial communities. We have longer periods of root exudation. Again, that's keeping these microbial communities more activated, and there's going to be a greater diversity in the labile carbon supply. So what I want to do is pull out and think about three processes that we are aware of based on, you know, fundamental science, and you might find some of these processes in textbooks. But I want to propose that these processes probably occur to a great extent in native soils, but we don't really understand or haven't really tracked them. And excuse me. And perhaps we can identify how or identify processes that may contribute to their function in agricultural soils. So the three processes that I want to speak briefly about are heterotrophic carbon dioxide assimilation. We always talk about how microbial communities in soil are carbon starved. And we don't think, when we talk about carbon sequestration, we talk about carbon being stored and increased in the form of organic matter. But the carbon dioxide that may be released during respiration might be serving a minor role in assimilation processes that may enhance sort of the carbon portfolio of soil microorganisms. Another process would be the reutilization of hydrogen as an electron donor. Hydrogen gas is kind of a universal energy currency that can be readily taken up by membranes. We know that there are soils that readily take up hydrogen gas from the atmosphere. And also when we have more quiescent soils, we have more biochemical gradients, so we could have situations where fermentative processes could produce hydrogen. And so, again, here's another example of expanding the energy portfolio of microbes in soils. And then a third is dissimilatory nitrate reduction to ammonium. And these are all processes that may very well happen in more native soils. Can we get them to happen in agricultural soils? So the first is heterotrophic carbon dioxide assimilation. There was a soil microbiology textbook by Martin Alexander that mentioned the fact that the presence of CO2 really enhances heterotrophic microbial growth. And it is due based on Krebs. The TCA cycle is also called the Krebs cycle. But the uptake of CO2 is due to a reaction where pyruvate carboxylate is catalyzing the addition of a carbon atom through bicarbonate to pyruvate to make oxaloacetate. And this is an energy-requiring step, but it is a way for CO2 to actually be fixed into the microbial biomass. And when you work with laboratory cultures, between 1% and 6% of the microbial of the biomass of bacterial cultures can actually come from external CO2. Roslev et al. Showed that where does that CO2 go? It ends up to a great extent in the membrane lipids of these heterotrophic bacteria. So is this happening in soils? Could this possibly be something we want to promote in soils to promote carbon use efficiency and more robust microbial activity? So this is a study by Miltner et al. Showing that soils do fix CO2, or there is heterotrophic incorporation of CO2. They used 14 CO2 to show that in the presence of manure, a labile carbon, there was a stimulation of the 14 CO2 incorporation into organic matter, and that it was linearly related to respiration. So it is a process that can really enhance the microbial biomass. After 20 days in this study, carbon dioxide uptake slowed, and thereafter, it accounted for 1% to 2% of respiration, but during that respiratory phase where CO2 assimilation and respiration were linked, the CO2 was coming in at about 3% to 5% of the net respired CO2. So that's heterotrophic consumption of carbon dioxide. The second process I wanted to mention was hydrogen utilization as an electron donor. And there are trace concentrations of hydrogen in the atmosphere that can be consumed by soils and the microbial communities there. It's known that hydrogen molecules have an average of average lifetime of 1.4 years, and that the main sink of hydrogen in the atmosphere is indeed biological consumption in soils. And it's been shown that soils will exhibit biphasic consumption of H2, so we know that there are microorganisms that have hydrogenase enzymes that can be both low and high affinity, just like ammonium oxidizers can have high and low affinity. And if you look at natural systems, there is a lot of H2 uptake, in particular by forest soils, as opposed to some of the grassland soils, and here you have a maize soil. So this is an example of differences in hydrogen uptake based on land use and vegetation. So CO2, hydrogen, the possibly enhancing energy and carbon supplies in soils. But then the third is alternative fates, particularly of nitrate. And this is kind of a classic diagram of the different possible fates of nitrogen in soil. And again, we have that problem of so much of our applied fertilizer nitrogen being lost. Well, this is a type of diagram of the different pools of nitrogen in the highly disturbed low organic matter soils versus less disturbed, more organic matter soils. But you'll see that the species of nitrogen in the soil, if you think about nitrogen that is reduced, whether it's organic or it's in the ammonium form, in managed systems, more of the nitrogen is available or is present in roots, inorganic forms, N2, N2O, and nitrate, and there's less available in roots, organic N, microbial biomass, and ammonium. So if you shift over to a system that is less disturbed and has more organic matter, there is a greater proportion of reduced nitrogen species as opposed to these more oxidized, more reactive species. So can we achieve soils and nitrogen cycling in soils in agricultural systems that mimic this to a much greater extent? So one possible process that might be happening to a greater extent in native soils and agricultural soils would be dissimulatory nitrate reduction to ammonia, or DNRA. We also call it NA, nitrite respiration, or nitrate respiration, or nitrite ammonification. It's pretty hard, I think, sometimes to talk about these to farmers, but that's why we like NA rather than DNRA. It's a little less cumbersome. But it is a two-step process where instead of nitrate going to nitrite and then to nitric oxide, N2O and or N2, the nitrite is reduced in a single reaction by this enzyme, NRF, nitrite reductase with formate, to ammonium. So the benefit of this particular process would be that you're extending the length of the residence time of the nitrogen atom because it is now ammonium, and it might be able to be taken up again by a microbe or by a plant root, or it might interact with the negatively charged cation exchange sites in soils. So there are some advantages for this possibly happening, especially in the upper levels of, say, a no-till stratified soil, so that the nitrogen would stay for a longer period in the soil. So the DNRA process is probably best studied in the favorite model organism E. coli. And we know that there are membrane-bound enzymes that are responsible for this process, DNRA. And it's more likely to occur under nitrate limiting and strongly reduced conditions. So again, how likely these conditions are to be established in agricultural soils is a big question. But I think by reducing oxidation reduction potential, or EH, in certain pockets of soils, enhancing spatial heterogeneity, also enhancing the availability of small molecular weight carbon compounds, these are things that are known to enhance DNRA. So we do know that it does occur in soils based on laboratory studies. Up to 5% of ammonium nitrate that was labeled with a 15N nitrate nitrogen was converted to 15N labeled ammonium in just 2 days, but added carbon was required. It did not happen without added carbon. So it does seem that this process can be favored by lower redox as well as higher carbon availability. So some of the people who've done more work on DNRA than most other people, Wendy Silver at University of California, Berkeley, has done a lot of work on looking at DNRA in different types of systems, but also a lot of scientists from Europe have investigated this. But you can see that if you look at this table here, these are nitrate ammonification rates, and this is nitrate ammonification as a proportion of the nitrate present in the soil, or the nitrate that has been reduced. And based on riparian environments and temperate forests here, you get quite a huge range in estimates. In fact, in these forest soils, you have a lot of DNRA or NA occurring up to about 100%. So it seems that denitrification is less of an important nitrate respiration process than DNRA. So again, this does seem to be happening in natural systems and in arable soils. Rates have been measured at, or I should say, NA over nitrate rates have been measured at from 0 to 6.3%. So we do know that these factors are helpful for promoting DNRA, reduced conditions, presence of roots, carbon, respirable carbon sources, higher carbon to nitrate ratios. So these are ideas for trying to understand how DNRA might be promoted. And we do know that one good source of labile carbon for this process could be manure. But the problem with manure is that there is a big trade-off, either with ammonia or N2O. So there, I think, is a good case to be made for using manure, but in moderation or in mixtures, so that there's less of an environmental trade-off. But just the reduction of tillage and increasing of organic matter could have differential results based on carbon to nitrogen balances, and management factors such as timing and quality of carbon inputs are going to be critical for improving our nitrogen use efficiency from an agricultural standpoint. So when we study DNRA, and that is the one process, I don't have any data myself on hydrogen utilization or heterotrophic carbon dioxide assimilation, but we do have some data available on DNRA in the Sustainable Dairy Cropping Systems project. We have been using primers that have been published. The first set of primers for this particular enzyme, nitrite reductase with formate, was published in 2004 by Mohan, but it's been used in a variety of different environments. But Alyssa Welsh at University of Illinois, who works in Rob Sanford's group, they did a lot of work in improving the primers, and they have been demonstrating that there are significant numbers of DNRA organisms in agricultural fields in Illinois. So I just want to point out that we are looking not just at raw manure, but also at processed manure. So one thing we have found, my postdoc Arnab Bomek is going to talk about this tomorrow, but we've shown that there are differences not just in DNRA gene copies across farms that the composition of the DNRA organisms looks like it's much more affected by anaerobic digestion. So these are plots showing the DNRA gene composition with respect to raw manure versus digested manure. So there's a big shift. Proteobacteria and Bacteroides are common enteric types of DNRA organisms in raw manure, but after the anaerobic digestion process, we have a lot of Borrelia microbia. So I was talking about how enteric, or the E. coli organisms, have been studied to the greatest extent. Well, when you're adding manure to soils, you're basically enriching soils with the DNRA organisms. So we are also interested in understanding how oxidation reduction potentials, and we are looking at both field as well as redox potential. But we have shown that oxidation reduction potentials really are very, very different in intact cores versus packed, sieved and packed mesocosms. So sieved packed soils have much lower redox potentials than intact soil cores. So it could be a reflection of the porosity and the structure that is in intact soil cores. So I think it's important to understand that if you're looking at trying to parameterize processes in laboratory mesocosms, you do have to be cognizant of this difference. And then also, cover crops can really have a big difference on the diurnal variation. These are just replicates of till and no-till and two different types of cover crop, but the alfalfa no-till has very extreme variations in oxidation reduction potential, up to 300 millivolts. So this is likely to be reflected by or due to the root systems. These are not in canola or alfalfa. This is corn that has followed canola and alfalfa. So just to point out that there are some processes that might be helpful for enhancing carbon use efficiency and might be helpful in making nutrient cycling a lot tighter in our agricultural systems, so that we might want to pay more attention to the types of conditions that can promote these processes. So thank you very much for your attention.
Okay. So if Marianne
wants to take one question, perhaps that'll lead into a larger
discussion.
Okay.
Well.
All right. Okay.
Great.
Other questions?
Other speakers? That was a really great question. Yeah, I wanted to thank all the presenters today, and also to remind everybody about the Soil Biology and Biochemistry business meeting tomorrow at noon. And